Welcome to Brain in a Vat. We are delighted to be joined by Trond Undheim, and we're going to be talking about catastrophic risk. Trond, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
So imagine we are in 2075 right now. What has happened is that the world's governments did not agree on any major decisions to slow down climate change. We had several world-threatening conflicts that amounted to world wars, but they were perhaps not at the scale that most people feared, but they destroyed a lot of environmental resources, obviously cost a lot of human lives. Governance structures are still recognizable. In other words, there are still governments around. There are still superpowers. They are more feeble than they were, and power is more dispersed, which means there's a little bit more conflict everywhere. Unfortunately, organized crime is pervasive. So think about a Latin American reality of who you can trust and not trust in public places. And that's the reality of the entire world. Everybody now lives like that. There is also tremendous difference between rich and poor. Even Scandinavian countries, Northern European countries, and the EU that prides themselves on welfare states, those states have become unsustainable. Most of the riches of the world and most material and mineral resources, first of all, the resources have already been extracted. And there is this great, great divide, not just economic divide, but it is truly a physical divide between those who have access to whatever is left of those resources and those who do not. And it's a cognitive divide. It is a mental divide. It is actually also a health divide, because 50 years from now, we will have medical technologies that will efficiently effectively for the top 1% of humanity, they will live about 30 average years of good quality life longer than everyone else. And the lower 5 to 10% of the population will have shorter, high quality lifespans than they had during the Industrial Revolution. That's a bit of a start to, I think, is one of the more realistic scenarios that we're looking at. This is a cascading risk scenario. It is nothing to do with existential risk. But I think it's also, it would be a year of great reflection, because it's a turning point. We have 25 years left of the 21st century. Arguably, most things you could do have been done. There's going to be kind of a fin de siècle type of terror, a psychological, global feeling that we are going in the wrong direction around the turn of the century. That's a certainty. So 2075 is going to be this time when most sane people will realize, where are we now? Well, we're not where we wanted to be. We have certain choices to make. But unfortunately, many choices are already made. And I think we are in a year where, despite great policymakers, fantastic speeches, you know, new crops of trillionaires who have fabulous ideas for grand projects, we would need a tremendous amount of luck and an enormous amount of progress in very little time to stop the kind of negative cascading spirals that we have gotten ourselves into.
People's reactions to risk are interesting. One way that many people treat risk is, if something bad didn't happen, then you shouldn't have worried in the first place. So the idea will be, well, you're worried about a third world war. If it turns out by 2075 there was no third world war, then all of that worry was unnecessary and unproductive. Do you think that's the right way to think about risk?
So I think there's a nutshell, there's a truth, a nugget of truth in what you're saying. I actually think worry is not productive. So what I'm talking about is not worry. It is either planning or I guess, thriving, right? So you can consider that an enormous amount of these changes are not purely necessary. So you could choose to sort of thrive on what we have right now and find a way that we can live much more productively within the limits that we have right now. And we are already at a very advanced state of technology and other things, and we are exploiting the Earth's resources. Or you could say, well, you know, we need to prepare then, right? So we need to make a significant amount of investments. And that's different from worry. Worry is a psychological affliction. It's debilitating. It stops you from doing intellectual, smart things and making choices. So I think what you're saying is right. The worry part is not productive. The planning part and the creating these scenarios, and I think this should not just be experts that are creating these. You can just try to imagine, and most of us are now, you know, literate enough in sci-fi, and you watch what's happening. There are no massive secrets, and the uncertainties that I'm talking about, they are actually out there in the open. The cascading effects, though, that I am investigating in more detail are a little bit more hard to come by. So I worry about them somewhat, but I am more proactively interested in planning mitigation against them. And we can talk about what they are, but there's two choices, right? There's these giga projects that aim to solve everything. And I have, you know, I'm studying a plethora of all these things. I mean, we've been trying to build forests across the Sahel Desert in, you know, to stop the Sahara desertification. There's now plans to build a massive curtain to stop the Arctic from melting down, right? So that we don't have 3 meters of seawater rise. These are mega and giga projects. They cost billions and eventually trillions of dollars. And then you have smaller things that I think are much more modular and scalable. So if that is what you mean by worry, if planning and science is part of worry, or making the conscious choice not to invest in giga projects, but actually to, if not slow things down, just basically say, we are going to try to understand what's happening on this planet right now and whether we're comfortable with it. And if it's not, we're going to make some changes.
So I just want to differentiate between a couple of things. The one is a known thing that will occur unless you take various steps. And the other one is an uncertain, risky thing that may or may not occur, and there's a degree of certainty about it. And as you've mentioned, the kinds of projects you could be involved in have a cost. So if you're going to be spending trillions of dollars on planting trees, well, if you're aiming towards an uncertain event, you could have spent a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of resources on something that never occurs. And that's where the bite comes in from Jason's question, which is assume that you plan for something that never happened. And you say, well, we thought it was reasonable to expect it to occur. We spent a lot of resources doing this. It never actually occurred. It seems like a bad thing has happened. In other words, the planning was for naught, and that you might have done something morally blameworthy in that action. If what you're saying is, no, we actually did get some bang for our buck, you know, the trees help in all these sort of ways, and so we could with certainty know we're going to have an effect, that seems different. But so let me give you an example where it's going to be existential risk. So you think there may be an asteroid that could collide with Earth, and it could wipe all of us out, and it's a 1 in 100,000 chance. And so you think, well, that's something worth taking some steps towards preventing. So you spend trillions of dollars designing a, you know, Reagan-esque Star Wars system so that you can shoot it out from the sky. But the asteroid never comes. But you spend all the money. You could have spent it on building bridges, on helping the poor, the poor, and you didn't. What should be our attitude towards the events not occurring?
Yeah, I mean, I think this ties in with what I'm saying, and this is what I'm challenging my students on this spring. It's, you know, generally for every kind of question you can ask, should we make a massive investment now and then suffer the consequences because it does have a cost? Or should we make a plethora, more of a portfolio of investments? And you could fix the problem in one go with this massive investment, or you could completely waste the investment. And I think the logical answer is that whether you go portfolio or large, it has to be modular in a sense that, I guess, you know, even though the space program, you know, historically was very hierarchical, it had these modular spin-offs that have benefited most of humanity. Now, I think there are 100,000 ways that the space program could have been designed in a truly modular way and would have had, you know, 1,000 more products that are useful to us beyond sort of microwaves and other things. So I think that is the kind of thinking we need to bake into to this discussion. Because if it truly is just building a Star Wars program to hit an asteroid or building these enormous, you know, miles and miles of sort of walls and carpets to try to slow down climate change or other types of geoengineering efforts. Carbon capture comes to mind as another one that, you know, we obviously can't stop investing in it, but it is at the moment with enormous scientific uncertainty about whether you ever will be cost effective. So whatever you do that is of that size, I think individuals as taxpayers have the responsibility to say, do I believe in this or not? And if I believe it is an important cause, how should it be done so that it immediately and always benefits more than just that individual project? Because then it surely isn't worth it. And morally probably is actually detrimental.
So that's fascinating. I have a different case in mind, which isn't really covered by your thought experiments and what you've discussed so far, but I think it informs your answer in these cases, which is suppose we know the thing's going to happen. We know the catastrophic event is going to happen. Suppose it's not just a 1 in 100,000 chance that the meteorite's going to hit Earth or the asteroid's going to hit Earth or the comet, whatever it is. Suppose we have calculated with near 100% certainty that in 600 years, that comet is going to strike Earth. Now the question is this generation obligated to fix the problem at great cost to this generation? So the next generation is going to suffer a little bit less of the cost, and the next generation less of the cost, and the next generation less of the cost, because presumably this generation will pay out of its pocket and out of its resources to solve the problem. Is this generation obligated to fix the problem? And the reason why I'm asking this question is because if you think that there's any reason why this generation is not so obligated in the case where you know it's going to happen, then surely it's the case that no generation's ever obligated to prevent a great existential, a great catastrophic risk when we don't know it's going to happen.
So, I mean, it's a brilliant question. And as you know, it's embedded in a lot of fine details that have been very controversial lately in the long-termist movement, because the implication of what you're saying at the extreme is that we should care more about future unborn humans, whether they be in the trillions or in the thousands, whoever's left, basically. But the assumption in most of these arguments is that if we don't impede them from living, there will be, you know, trillions of people who would have had the chance to live, and we need to at all costs defend their chance to do so. I think that for all practical and even sort of like social ethical reasons, it's a contrived argument. I am much more a believer in this sort of, tribal argument that, you know, you should think about the next few generations ahead of you. And I think even that is such an enormously long-term perspective. When I started my effort at 2075, it was not because I didn't want to look 600 years into the future. I would have loved to. I mean, that's sci-fi. It's exciting. There just is no data. And there's even very little data on what might be projections or cascades and interactions between things we already know for 2075. So at least as a scientist and a thinker trying to do scientifically informed futurism and scenario projection, that's a little bit out of scope. But I understand where you're coming from. The strange thing is, my thought experiment for 2075, we have done some quantitative modeling. There's a paper coming out soon. And out of, you know, a plethora, probably hundreds of thousands of interactions that are fairly probable, there are at least 10 or 15 of these interactions that with some certainty could happen. And our model shows that even if just three of them happen in short order, in and around the next, you know, 50 years, that we would go into something that makes the Great Depression look like it was just a little lunch break. So I'm not talking about knowing the future. I'm talking about very certain plausibilities of really catastrophic, economically damaging, and I'm sure psychologically damaging things that would hurt the moral fiber of society. So the strange thing is what you're saying is with some certainty happening, and I don't think it's a big secret either, and we're not really doing much about it, so there's your answer.
So I appreciate the modesty in terms of how much we could know about the future or what we could know about how we could solve the problems of the future. If you think back 600 years and you imagine that civilization trying to conceive of what the world looks like now, it's laughable. You know, many of the things that we currently take for granted could not have been conceived by a generation 600 years ago. But maybe if you say your time horizon is 50 years, we can imagine that people in 1975 could conceive of what we have now. You had an early internet in 1975. You had space travel. You had, you know, a lot of the things that look similar. So I appreciate the modesty. But when you're doing your calculations, what kind of model are you using? So you could be utilitarian, where you're just counting up the amount of hedons or pleasure or utils. And we know that if I hit your hand with a hammer right now, that causes a certain amount of suffering. Okay. When we look at something like cataclysmic change from climate change, we have, as you say, a scenario of the kinds of suffering it could cause, but we don't have a sense of certainty. And we do know that there are many costs involved if we wanted to mitigate the climate change. So, for example, you get radical calls for people never to jump on an airplane ever again, or as you mentioned at the beginning, to radically degrow. Which means the poorest of the poor who might have access to fossil fuels so they can get themselves out of poverty won't have that stuff. So we accept a huge amount of upfront pain in the hope that it prevents a lot of future pain. And so I'm wondering, how do you do the calculation? One method would be to say, let's allocate a percentage chance of this event occurring. So it's 1 in 100,000. And you then divide the pain that could be caused by 100,000. And so you say, well, you know, every 100,000 points of pain in the future is worth one in the present. That could be one method you could use. The other one would be to treat it as if it were identical, to say, well, let's assume the thing will occur. And so pain points in the future are the same as pain points now. And so we can spend pleasure points now in this current currency to mitigate against that. So what's the calculation that you use?
Well, I mean, the calculation that I would want to use would be one of probability. I know a bunch of existential risk researchers have tried to use it. I wish we were there. I have tried to devise a system that would get us closer to start thinking about how we could get there. But I think we're still waiting for the quantum computers that would be able to compute the implications, even if we had some modest probabilities, because this goes from my cascading argument, which is we are not trying to defend ourselves from a few more like 10 named crises, when you can think of supervolcanoes and AIs and aliens, and you know, you can make the count and climate change, and then you'll synthetic biology gone rogue and world war, next, you know, big war, world war, or perhaps just economic collapse. So, you know, these are sort of like now a little more than my 5 scenarios. But the reality of this is that there's probably at least 140 such factors that I have mapped that will and are already colliding together in various constellations. And even if you look at the concept of dyadic risk, which is, you know, two things colliding, and it could be as simple as, you know, the economy crash or technology. The one that's studied the most is technology and the environment crashes. And Fukushima might be the best example. You're building this massive nuclear reactor close to the ocean, happily, you know, using the ocean to cool your reactor. Then comes the tsunami and says, you know, you can't control nature. And now you have a NATEC accident, which is supposedly nature causing the accident. But of course, it's a correlation, and it is as much of a human created disaster as it is a natural one. And that's kind of the best example. I have then mapped 36 other such interactions. And then you can start doing probabilities based on that. And those are just two things interacting. If you start thinking that two or three of those things are interacting at multiple points in time, this is why weather analysis still can't tell you the weather in more than 3 to 5 days ahead, right? So even if we had some probabilities, we would still be stuck with the math questions, and they are maybe not even solvable by the first few generations of quantum computers. So the short answer to your question is, when we did our calculations, we were basing it on something much more simplistic. We were simply looking at curves for a few indicators in these big areas that I'm looking at. So, you know, what's happening to technology, what's happening to the environment, what's happening to business dynamics and industry, what's happening to social dynamics and culture and people and their psychological attitudes to all these changes. Generally what's happening to all of these things. And then we devised a few known indicators based on, things like the speed of semiconductor development and other things that just are historical data that exists over 10 to 15 years in the past. We projected various curves, and then we said, in the event of these various occurrences that I have talked about in the in these five distinct scenarios, what if some of those scenarios happened in short order and they started sort of both happening at the same time? What would be? And then we simply modeled the economic impact. We didn't even go into the number of lives lost. And even that analysis, which is kind of a playing with statistical indices and stuff, got pretty sophisticated. Yet it was using an enormously crude method that we have known about, right? That kind of statistics we have essentially known about for 200 years. But if you were to do it in any more advanced way, it would just rapidly require the kind of computation that we can only dream of today.
So you mentioned that by 2075, there's certain risks that you think have a fairly high, or a worryingly high, if I can use the word worry, a worryingly high probability of happening. I'm curious what those are. And then a second question is, do you think that as the world becomes more complex, so as technology grows, as the number of people on Earth grow, as the system of the Earth, the people on the Earth become more complex, as society becomes more complex, is catastrophic risk more likely? So is that just correlated with the complexity of the system?
To answer your first question, second question first, I think not. I don't think complexity is necessarily evil or bad or risky. I think complexity is something that any system has. We are just at the very beginning of understanding that kind of complexity. You could even say that the world has always been very complex. It's just that our understanding of it hasn't been complex. So as we start to slowly understand more about our real risks, I think it'll rebalance. The argument has been made that, you know, the hydrogen bomb was the first time that we discovered that we could extinguish our own human nature by just a push of a button. But I think that possibility has always been there. And there are things that could have happened earlier in our history, coming from outside the Earth, certainly, that we had no protection from. But even diseases, right? There are probabilities in those, in human nature, and there's probabilities in nature. And all of those could have caused, and, you know, I guess epidemics of the past did cause that kind of grievance that we are today afraid of multiple times over, right? So the scale of the destruction might be perhaps different in the worst case scenario we can imagine today or in 50 years, but humanity has actually, any society has systematically had the opportunity to destroy either themselves or the next civilization over, or their neighbor. And that does not change. It is our attitude to these things and what we do to mitigate them when we discover how high the risk is, and then the choices we make saying, well, that's unacceptable, we're not going to go there, or we're going to try to do something about it. But I don't necessarily think this is a bad life to work on the assumption that life is a precious resource. I think is actually a healthy starting point. And it, I don't think my work with risk has not taken away my enjoyment of life, quite the opposite. The way I think about existential risk is, it's a little bit like receiving a terminal cancer diagnosis. So the moment you get it, you are obviously distraught and it kind of destroys everything. Most people, within a month, turn that around and they spin it into, now that I know this, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And they live whatever, 1 week, 1 month, 2 years. Some people live 10. Some people then get healed of their cancer, but they live a better life. And that's, I think, the way that we need to coin the reaction to cascading and existential or catastrophic, whatever you want to call these risks. The more we know about them, the more we can thrive.
So it seems like you could have two different methods for dealing with cascading risk. The one is that you have some central authority that tries to study all the risks in the manner that you have, and you have legions of people who think about what the risk could be, and you spend a lot of people's money trying to solve them. And the other one is do nothing. And I'm going to give you an argument for do nothing, which is that the central planners tend to get things wrong quite badly often, and they may introduce more risks through their solutions. So, for example, you can think about the development of the nuclear bomb. The idea was, well, this is going to be a device that will end all wars. People will be so petrified of being nuked that they won't fight with each other. But actually, as you say, it creates this device that could kill all of us. And so it might very well be that the central planners who are trying to solve many of the risks along the way end up introducing more risks. And so if you just do nothing, if you let people, lead their own lives, get on with their own lives, that organically what you'll find is that solutions come up to the various problems. We must also recognize, of course, that there have been people calling for, the end of the world or prophesizing a doomsday, for thousands of years, and they've always been wrong. So how do you differentiate this kind of modern doom-mongering from eschatologists of yore?
Implementers would in all likelihood turn militaristic. It would lead to the kinds of giga projects that the Manhattan Project was just one example of. And I actually think the probability is very high that we will see at least five such projects before 2075. And I could think with you about what they are. I would hope, though, they are differently organized. But actually, the answer to the question, the ideal answer that I have in my head, is that we do something much more dispersed. Even just making use of existing science and challenging every scientific researcher and every thinker, everyone who's working in a domain and becomes, a bit of an expert in their domain, we need to foster transdisciplinarity and thinking about risk in all existing domains. I would much rather have an army of experts in every country, in every local university, and they don't even have to just work at a university. Knowledge is available freely these days, and you can work in a nonprofit and work on these things. I would much rather have people across 25 disciplines dispersed, not organized, thinking about these things. And then if some radical need comes up, they come together and use their know-how to solve a problem than to have this like massive monolithic organization that sits there and oversees risk, with their supercomputers. That I think is going to be hard to prevent in large countries like the US and in institutional systems like the EU. There is that inclination, and those institutions will be created. The only justification, I think, for such an institution is in the health area, but even then, I think they should be regionally, operational units, right? There should be sort of like stormtroopers on every continent. We would have needed it for the pandemic. But I think a sort of world government version of this is very, very easily totalitarian.
So I want to, the science fiction author in me wants you to answer that first question I asked, which is, which are the three most likely scenarios to happen that are catastrophically risky for humanity by 2075? Because I think a lot of people will say, well, it's easy to talk about this happening or that or that or that or that and just list out all the possible scenarios. That's almost unfalsifiable, because what really happens is going to be in the list of scenarios. But if we were to try and knuckle you down to a specific prediction, what would it be?
Well, so the first and the easiest one is to say that with, you know, one of the five plausible scenarios is that within the next 50 years, we are already at the end of a growth cycle, if you are to believe any kind of economic cycles that last, you know, in various theories between 50 and 100 years. Either way, we are going to be at the end of at least a mega cycle in economics. Last time we had the Great Depression, this time we could have something bigger. I would say odds are that it's going to be something bigger. Now, the Great Depression was not the end of the world, but it was pretty bad for those that were affected. And we're still analyzing it, by the way, right? It had really strange effects. And the world actually rebounded surprisingly fast, you know, within 7 to 10 years. But Europe only rebounded because after the Second World War, for to take a different example, in the war arena, which is my other scenario, some big war, Europe only rebounded from the war because of an intentional effort by a large power, United States, that decided to offer help, right? So these things are not automatic. And it's not like we have seen an economic cycle and it went well after a few years, so we shouldn't worry about that. We have seen a Second World War, and, you know, actually, you know, we're all fine now. There is no sort of natural logic to these things. There were decisions made. Policymakers said, we are going to rebuild Europe. And they basically, you know, gave a Marshall Plan size, you know, assistance over years and years. The challenge, I think, is bigger with my third scenario, which is this climate cataclysm, because there, the economic mechanisms are more difficult. And were we to truly think of this as an actual existential crisis, as opposed to some inconvenience that we think we're going to basically solve with technology anyway, I think that would be my third candidate, that we will discover pretty clearly before 2075 that many things, including biodiversity, not necessarily just the heating of the atmosphere, but actual biodiversity, cannot be reversed. And the moment you realize that, you know, we are living in a very different world. And the only solution out of that in human lifetimes is synthetic biology to recreate species at an astounding scale, which synthetic biology is far away from being capable of doing today. So it's probably also unrealistic in our lifetime. I guess the last one that we haven't talked so much about would be sort of runaway AI, the argument that artificial intelligence is now developing some sort of own, if not consciousness, but at least, you know, consequences, and are spitting back real world actions, whether it is intentional or could be used by someone or not. In my scenario, the only way that runaway AI could become a sort of earth-shaking negative impact by 2075 is collusion between state or non-state actors and that AI. And I think we are seeing that in many places of the earth, because never perhaps has a technology been so sought after by governments to control the narrative around future of evolution of industry and technology. And the military consequences and implications are profound and misunderstood. Runaway technology destroy journalism and destroy childhoods for entire generations of people. Cohorts, they will never recover. They have lost the faith in what's real in the world. And that's on us. It was fixable. It was not hard to understand, but I've been advising parliaments for many, many years, and we have to start often with explaining how email works and what the internet really was and what it did. So we are 30 to 50 year behind in the technology cycle in the world's legislative bodies when it comes to understanding even the surface level what these technologies have done.
So I understand the idea that you could have a cascade. So you could have one risk which creates a domino effect and a whole series of other things happen and, you know, becomes truly catastrophic as the dominoes continue to fall. But I could also imagine that you could have risks that cancel each other out. So one that we haven't discussed at the moment is the idea of depopulation. So there is a view that because we have a declining birth rate, that humanity will peak at maybe 8, 9, 10 billion and then dramatically crash down to about 2 billion. And that most places on Earth have a lower than population replacement level. And it seems that if you had a population that plunged in size, that would probably have a whole range of other effects, some of which would be good for the environment, let's say, that you'd have less consumption, less travel, less need for fossil fuels. And so it seems like that scenario could have a positive effect on some of the other risks that you've taken into account. And I wonder if you think about a reverse cascade of one bad thing happening that then sets off other things that are actually good.
Yeah, I mean, there's tremendous potential in thinking about positive cascades or to think of, about cascades going in every direction. That's the whole point with a cascade, right? It doesn't signal where it's going. So it could go, it's more like a ravine. It goes the way it goes, right? But unlike water, it's not predictable in that sense. Like it doesn't follow geological laws because it follows systems dynamics laws, and those are poorly understood even by systems dynamics people because we can't even model these things. It is ethically a little questionable territory to talk about what's the ideal population of the planet. Many have tried between, in the early days, I think people were saying 100,000 is enough. We have enough ethnic variability and there's no problem there. Others have said 1 million. That number is out the window. I think 1 billion is a pretty sustainable number, yeah. But to sit here and gamble or plan for, worst case, that the population is going to dwindle down from 10 to 1 billion, I think would be, it's hard for a public planner to have that as their perspective. So you would have to have much more evidence that is actually happening. The other challenge with it is, of course, talk about degrowth. And I felt like you were mischaracterizing degrowth a little bit. Degrowth isn't the hell that people want it to be. I think most contemporary degrowth scholars, the ones that aren't completely, on this path that, everything about capitalism was always, or growth was always unethical. I think most degrowth scholars today are cutting it somewhat of a middle ground. They're just saying, let's not pursue endless growth as our main objective. Let's grow, and I do not want to use sustainable, but let's grow in a manner that is more conducive to understanding what we're actually doing and what the effects are of that growth. And modeling a little further out, not 600 years that you want me to do, but let's, I think, modestly, modeling 50 years out would be fabulous. There are no countries that do this. Nuclear technology is the only thing that we have a 1,000-year consequence analysis and risk analysis on. All other technologies, even in the EU, where they're very serious about impact assessment, they're never assessing the risks of a technology over centuries. The AI Act that's now coming into force, hopefully next year, it has these risk levels. But the concern there is essentially with the current voting population, how mad they would be at them. The concern is not with anything else. So it would be a tremendous breakthrough if the world's governance systems could start thinking 5 years ahead, 10 years ahead, 25 years ahead, and I think maybe stop at 50 until we have better data. Anything else, you're not planning anything, you're just in the realm of science fiction, which is fantastic. It just, you can't use it for policy planning.
So just two things. The one is we can predict the movement of celestial bodies with enormous accuracy. So we know, for example, that the sun eventually is going to expand and envelop the Earth. We know eventually that our galaxy is going to crash into the Andromeda galaxy. We know certain things, and we could discover a comet and know that that's going to hit the Earth. And then it would be very interesting, given the knowledge that this is going to happen in many generations' time, maybe a few hundred years' time, how that should impact our decisions today. So that's just the first observation. The second is returning to something you said right at the beginning of the conversation. I thought it was a really clever answer to Mark and my objection, which is, it was a question slash objection, which is, if you deal with catastrophic risk, you do so at great cost. And maybe that's a good reason not to do so, especially given that that catastrophe might never happen. And you said, well, the way you should best deal with it is in a modular fashion. So you deal with it in a way that it has these offshoots that benefit society as a whole, so that should the catastrophe never eventuate, you still have these benefits that you can draw on. What's interesting is that might not be a good solution to the way individuals respond to risk. So let's say you as an individual, not you as humanity, are thinking about how to prepare for a zombie apocalypse, how to prepare for a horrendous bout of a terrible pandemic. You can't prepare in a modular fashion as easily as a government can, as a state can. So it seems like a state can start to develop technologies that can be used in other ways. But you as an individual have to either stock your cellar full of stuff or not. And
you want my answer to that? Because mm-hmm. I've thought about this. Mm-hmm. I should probably be earning thousands of dollars in speaking fees to tell you this simple truth. But so even my students, right, they have visas to New Zealand and they are ready for everything and they have bunker plans. And, you know, it's they have, you know, in California, everyone has a catastrophe kit. Even in Norway, where I grew up, the government has actually surprisingly become a prepper and encouraged everyone to have their catastrophe kit. So I think this, interestingly, the consciousness of a prepper is the 21st century response to what you're saying. The problem with it is that it's upside down. I would do something completely different. And I have a humanistic approach and a sociological answer to catastrophe prepping. I think as an individual, the only thing that makes sense is to apply Dunbar's number. So surround yourself, and you could start with Jesus, surround yourself with 12 disciples that are sufficiently diverse and can help you, right? Someone should be economically literate and have capital for, you know, in gold, ideally. But you need a person like that wherever you are. So if you are in New York, you need to have that person in physical proximity, because you don't know. Maybe the pandemic shuts down the city. You need access to economic resources from someone who is imminently trustable by you to you. And the same goes for emotional stability, for all of the Maslowian needs, right? Food, security, all these kinds of things, but also love and affection. And eventually, I think the magical number is around 200. You need 200 100% trusted individuals, possibly that know, some of them know each other, and you have to curate those relationships over years. That is your best chance of survival under any scenario. They should be scientists, they should be economists, they should be public policy planners. You need hairdressers. I mean, you need all the basic functions that a society has. You need to be able to cover that wherever you at any point find yourself. So that cancels out, you know, going to Vermont and trying to survive unless you know everybody around there. It cancels out trying to get a visa to New Zealand because you would never get a flight in time if things shut down there. A lot of things become different if you think about it in human terms.
Well, over the last 4 years, we've interviewed roughly 200 people in a wide variety of areas. There's just one catch.
Maybe you have the answer.
They're all philosophers. So we'll have some fantastic discussions as the asteroid comes to get us or the zombies come to chop off our heads. But I don't imagine they'd be the most practical bunch. If any of our prior guests want to, you know, put their bona fides up and be on our little survivor ship, you know, put your hand up now. There's, of course, a great Douglas Adams book where you find out that all of our ancestors were on a ship like that. And, you know, they're sort of told that they're going to be the savior of humanity, but they're actually all the useless people. So they're like marketing managers and, you know, telephone hand sanitizers and, you know, people like this. And that's our true ancestry. Of course, everyone else dies because someone forgot to sanitize a telephone and they, you know, got a disease. And so there are no truly brilliant people floating around the universe. That's the Douglas Adams line, at least.
Yeah, it's hard. It's always easy to underestimate. I mean, hard to estimate. You know, the resources you actually need access to. But I also want to say that I don't think planning really is planning for something that catastrophic is a much larger thing. So I also don't think that to look upon it as an individual and say, well, I need all these useful relationships to me, that's also the wrong way. I think the community-based approach to this kind of thinking makes a lot more sense, and it's also probably more practical. So then why not engage in your local community? Everybody lives in a town, everybody lives on a street, right? Not every street has every resource, and unfortunately the world is full of very locations with a lot of hardships. But this is largely how the disaster research community sees recovery from any disaster. There are variables for recovery, and inadvertently, there are places that recover much faster than others, and that's where there already is social capital, or even there was a previous history of a disaster. Research shows that those places recover much more and very surprisingly quickly, because they have experienced that thing before. So I think simulating or actually experiencing catastrophe is your best preparation for a catastrophe. I almost died in a burning bus in Italy on a biking trip where we decided to take the bus. Well, I have a lot of strategies for getting fast out of an exploding bus, you know, in a smoky tunnel. Does that prepare me for everything? No. But if I ever see a bus that is, you know, smoking like I did, driving into a tunnel, I will be a little quicker, you know, in my moves. So I think that is the truth about everything. Yeah, that experience is the best prepper.
How do you deal with collective action problems when it comes to trying to prevent catastrophe? So a good example is climate change. Suppose for a moment that we agree that climate change is happening, that it's man-made, that we all individually are contributing to it, that lots of countries have contributed to it, and lots of individuals within those countries. Each person, it seems, can make no difference. So it makes no difference whether I recycle or not. It makes no difference whether I run my bathwater a bit longer, save some electricity. It will make no difference to whether in 2075 there is a climate catastrophe. Zero difference. But if everyone thought that way, then the catastrophe in 2075 is certain. So what you need is you need each person to do the thing that they no, has no causal efficacy, but if everyone does it, then you get the right outcome. How do you deal with that? And how should you motivate people, or should you motivate people? Should it be up to individuals, or should some state actor step into the equation and try and force people to behave in the right ways?
Well, I think that behavioral economics has shown in a pretty convincing way how what you're saying technically might be true, but in its consequence, if humans model behavior, others follow. And the strange thing is, you know, what I do in my house may not directly affect anything outside it, but human beings are strange. We have this uncanny ability to sense what other people want us to do. And intention can sometimes be unspoken. So I think it matters more that your intent is to do generally good things than the amount of kilos that you recycle and the fact that you probably, you know, go on an airplane. If your intent is, for all practical purposes, to contribute to the world, the general direction of your life is one that has a positive impetus on your friends, on your community. And eventually, those kinds of behaviors collectively, that is what a vote turns out to be. Those are decisions that we make. So it is a little simpler and more difficult than what you presented. It's not a rational thing. If it was, you know, you were adding up 1 + 1 + 1, and then eventually get to 1 million, and then that's enough, and then you have a tipping point. But I think social relationships are much more complicated. Human beings are influenced by other things. And if we were all sitting there as like, you know, rational individuals, we wouldn't get anything done, because you would actually just sit there and wait for everybody else to take a move, and then you would react to that. And that's not how life happens, is it? So I think we prove through our daily actions that these econometric models for behavior, they would stifle us if they were true, but they're not. We just don't have a very good systemic explanation for what it is that we actually are doing and why we even do anything at all. So the best proxy is behavioral economics, which I think is a poor man's theory, but it gets the point. I don't think it's in any way accurate. I think it's just one model explanation to explain why what you're saying is not true.
So one way of thinking about how people collectively act is like a flock of birds. So it could look like there is a leader bird who's directing everyone to go in a particular direction, but that's not really what's going on. What you have is each bird looking left and right and sort of following within those parameters. And I think that is what people are doing. As you say, there's not a rational calculation. People kind of go, well, it seems like my neighbors all recycle and they talk about it, so I guess I should do it as well. Here's the difficulty, which is that the kind of behavior that people model themselves on might be either worthless or counterproductive. So if we think about something like recycling, there was a famous paper written about 20 years ago, which said that almost all recycling is totally worthless. So there's like reusing glass bottles is useful, or recycling tin is useful, but paper and plastics, complete waste of time. And the response at the time was to say, well, enough people will look left and right and start replicating the behavior that you'll get these efficiency models. And so the author of that paper revisited it 20 years later and he said, no, it's still pretty worthless. And it might be actively bad. So for example, it's just not efficient to recycle plastics. So you create this big industry. At some point, the Americans decided that they should rather ship the stuff off to China. The Chinese will go and make you know, bits of linoleum floor with all of the American plastics. And then the shippers kind of realized, well, actually, you can save by just dumping the stuff in the ocean and going back halfway through, and you just keep doing that because the Chinese really can't do much with the recycled plastics. Now you've got a bunch of plastics in the ocean. So everybody with good intentions, looking left and right, ended up doing a really bad thing. And so it does seem like as a model for positive change, the raw fact of human nature isn't very good on that front, if you don't have people at least aiming in the right direction.
Yeah, but Mark, I don't know that the flaw here is in human nature. The flaw was in the industrial system of extraction and logistics and supply chains that really is not conducive to making recycling a very fruitful type of behavior. But I still recycle in the town that I currently live, mostly because it's fairly convenient and it feels good. And I don't think that's bad. And I think in that particular town, they do at least more than the average. I don't think they can stop plastics from being sent on big ships to Asia, where it does damage to rivers and has to be picked up by the Great Ocean Project. So I think I agree with your analysis. I just don't think that you should discount human intent. And so you have to distinguish, I think, between good human intent, and then the systemic understanding of what actually happens. Now, we need to get better at understanding our system, but that does not mean that we should stop having good intent.